what gets really interesting is in a model-driven world where everybody's building apps and chasing the same customers, where does the differentiation reside?
Yeah.
Right? And so our argument is that the differentiation resides in the diversity of data structure that your model sits.
Hey, and welcome to the Momentum Podcast, the show where fintech meets AI. I'm your host, Stan Altschuler, investor, founder, an advisor to some of the world's top hedge funds, asset managers, and data companies. Each week, we'll dive into practical AI strategies to help you cut through the noise, beat data overload, build smarter workflows, and turn your ideas into results. We'll explore everything from AI tools for your daily workflows to building data-driven growth engines for your organizations. Here, you'll discover what's next in finance and how to stay ahead of the curve with AI. Let's dive in. And welcome to the Momentum Podcast. This is your host, Stan Altschuler, and we've got a great guest today, Kirk, the CEO and founder of CarbonARK. Kirk, welcome to the show.
Hey, Stan. How you doing? Thanks for having me. Looking forward to this.
Absolutely. We're going to have a great conversation. Can you start off, maybe just give us a brief background about yourself, give us an overview of the journey and how you came to start the company?
Sure. So I spent 20 years on the buy side. So I started my career at Tudor Investments up in Boston in 2000 to age myself, and spent a couple of years there in the private equity group where I was dialing and smiling for deals and working on projects as an analyst. Went back to business school and then I landed at Glenview Capital. I was at Glenview for almost 7 years and I built a private research business there. That private research business was largely centered around human intelligence or collection through calls, channel checks. Ended up going over to work at SAC Capital in 2012, where I spent the next 8.5 years building and running a bunch of different research businesses, at Point72, what became Point72, ran marketing intelligence, proprietary research, by the time I left in 2021.
And you're known in the industry for pioneering some of the research work with alternative data. And you've been there from the start of kind of like hedge funds starting to use that data and to think about it. Can you give me a sense of like, what was the main problem that you've identified and thought this needs a completely different solution?
Well, it's interesting because it's sort of a two-part answer. The first part was, When I was working at Glenview, I was an analyst. I was covering consumer tech in the US and Europe, and I was hired to go over to be part of the European team under John Roden when we opened up the office there in 2006. But what was interesting was, based on my background at cold calling, coupled with I'm comfortable talking to sort of folks in sort of all spaces. Larry Robbins, pointing out that, where my faculties lay and where I had an advantage was primary research. And so at a young age in my career, I was tapped to sort of build a primary research business at Glenview, which was basically built on top of the expert network space in 2006, 2007. Early days building out that business, figured out how to create competitive advantage on top of what was a commodity platform product. Everybody had access to calls. It was about doing the calls in a certain way, in a systematic way. And so learned at a young age in my career that you could build an alpha product on top of beta. And so, sitting in my seat later when data had proliferated this the street in a more meaningful way, I was buying a fair amount of data. In buying a fair amount of data, I was exposed to all of the frictions associated with buying data.
Right.
And a lot of those frictions still exist today. Sales cycles are quite long. You can spend between 30 days and 9 months trying to get a data set, of scale into your environment. And then you have to, then the commercial terms are quite opaque, which is another friction. There's testing terms, and then there's ownership terms and licensing, and that can take time. Then there's the usability, right? This data can be huge. It can be really hard to work with. It can be varying stages of quality or what have you. And then at the end of it all, you still have to make a decision. And that decision is usually made by somebody downstream that isn't actually working in the data. So how do you create the ecosystem that allows for sort of the right information to transfer through the value chain. And so all those frictions created a space where there were a small number of buyers, an artificially high clearing price per data structure, and the clearing price for data structure kept the buyer community small, and the buyer community being small kept the data structure to be expensive. And so you had this natural problem where the market structure just wasn't set up the right way. And so I had a view that if you could build a platform that could remove a lot of those frictions, you could achieve density and velocity of consumption and expand the TAM from those 500 qualified buyers making up a number to 5 million. And that would sort of then open up the data provider side, which then would open up the ability to consume side. And so it was really about sort of trying to create that flywheel.
Excellent. And I wonder if some of the bigger players kind of enjoyed seeing that and enjoyed seeing their edge being whittled away. If you're democratizing the access to all this data, does the alpha also get diluted in some way? And let's leave that for a little bit later. We're gonna dive into like alpha generation later. For now, can you tell me about another big problem? Let's say I'm working at a hedge fund and I'm doing research on Lulu or something or another name. Do I need to buy a whole big data set of credit cards, even though I'm looking for something very small and very specific? Is that friction that you've thought about?
Absolutely. So, you know, what's interesting about credit cards, a great place to start in talking about, you know, sort of data sets, data structure, because it's pretty mature at this point. You know, if you look back to the early days of credit card, you know, Majestic Research, I think, was one of the first players to have credit card data on the sell side. That's now M Science, obviously, a later iteration. And sort of there's still, you know, a hallmark on the sort of sell side around alternative data research. But at a fundamental level, you started to see credit card data proliferate around 2012, 2013. At that time, those were expensive licenses, you know, really large assets. And there were only a few of them, right? And some of the major players out there who still exist today were selling that data at scale to large funds. Resellers came along, stood in front of data and started to sell what I would call sort of aggregation products. And that sort of started to proliferate. So that by 2018, having access to the data became table stakes and, you know, something that every firm really needed visibility into. In 2013, there was alpha just having it. But, you know, sort of what's interesting is you never saw, you know, sort of because there were a few players selling, there were a small number of discrete assets upstream. It kept a high price on credit card data, such that even though it's become table stakes, it has been stubbornly high at a row level framework. And you haven't seen sort of a proliferation of the ability to buy data at scale on a per ticker basis. We've attacked that problem head on. Consumption based pricing is a relatively new concept to the street. We were early in sort of thinking about that and trying.
You guys are innovating that's literally a new way to consume data. And I think you guys are the innovators on that front.
Definitely at the sort of the time series data structure, there are people selling KPIs but a lot of the stuff that one of the things that we did to try to innovate was to try and transform the way the license structure worked, because historically what's always been sort of a stubborn pole in the tent has been the bring your own license framework. And so, that still required friction for vendors and customers to engage around a license construct. In order to do that, it's required a lot of work to develop the supplier community, develop the platform and really educate and evangelize around how it could all work. That's what we've been spending a lot of time doing over the past several years. We've got a great set of partners and suppliers upstream. We make credit card data available in blocks the old fashioned way, right? You can buy the whole thing still. Aggregated sort of all you can eats and also by the drip and then through an MCP. So like you could actually show up and face up with credit card data and any other data in our platform any way you want, right? And what's best for you. You might be a data acquisition person in a large fund. You might be a data scientist in a small fund. you might be a data scientist at a large fund, and everybody's engaging with the data in a different modality.
And the value that you provide to investors is really going to be tied to the partners that you can bring to the platform, the underlying data. And credit card is just a fraction of it. You've got other app data and web script data and all the different types of data. Was it tricky to convince your partners to buy into this new model of consumption, because they are used to these big blocks, right? Contract, year, whatever, more, six-figure deals. They're selling the whole lot and they don't have to worry about it. Versus here now, you're giving the funds the ability to be a lot more granular. How did you get the partners to buy into that and be like, okay, we'll do it?
So with the partners, it depends on the asset class, right? And it depends on the partner's sort of time in the space, right? So for the incumbents and who have big install bases and huge businesses, where we work with those, and we work with some, but not all, the conversation really centered around, okay, you've got your install base. How do we move you? How do we help you find other markets or other participants that may not have participated before, but now can, right? And we built in with our, you know, sort of commercial partners protections around their core business, so we're not creating channel conflict. You know, at the end of the day, it's a lot of it just really came down to working hand in hand with partners and suppliers. For folks who are just breaking in, they don't have an install base that they're engaging around, and or they don't have a traditional business that they're disrupting. It's really hard to disrupt yourself, right? And that's not a statement on reticence or not wanting to. You just have a core business that's running, and, you know, sort of figuring out how to sort of augment and inform is also sort of, it just takes some time and energy. And so we work with incumbents, we work with new entrants. We just have to be really thoughtful around making sure that there's true alignment so that we're not bumping into each other or causing each other problems 6 months, right? There's nothing good on that front. And so we want to make sure that we're transparent in an open book with our suppliers. And we're also sort of very clear on what we can and can't do with customers.
That's great. From the investment manager side, or just data consumer, because you're not focused on just investment managers, which is interesting. The TAM is much, much bigger for you. But from the side of the data consumer, what does this new model look like? How granular can they get? And, you know, just in terms of like getting data for a specific question they're trying to answer, versus how long do I need this data for? Maybe I just need a little bit of historical data and I'm going to be monitoring it for the next 2 months. How does that work for the consumer?
So, you know, everything that goes through the API on the platform is aggregated. It's aggregated with backtests, and it's white box. It's white box work, so you can get in there and understand everything that's happening in the data. You know, if you want to buy 2 years of history and then you want to monitor for 3 months, you know, everything is priced on a per megabyte basis. So if you're pulling down 2 years of credit card data, a megabyte is about 17,000 rows of card data. You know, you pull down, you know, 2 megabytes, $X, you own the history when you pull it. And then if you want to run it weekly in your API, you only pay for what you're pulling, that's new, right? So we have an attribution against history, and you can sort of, you know, stop taking that whenever you want, fully consumption. If you want to do work, you know, sort of, you know, in row level, you know, sort of there are ways to engage around that depending on who the partner is. To be able to take some of it, you know, sort of to do sort of hybrids with aggregated row level. Where one of the fun parts, once you remove the inflexibility of a traditional license, is you can start to structure deals, because everything is a rev share. So we you know, sort of our suppliers are participating in every engagement that we have, and so long as, you know, sort of we're making sure we're keeping everybody aligned around what we're working in. We can create pretty flexible solutions for our customers, because one of the things you see is right now what's going on in the Middle East, for example, is really important, you know, to understand what's going through the straits and how that works. So you might want to be looking at shipping data, and you might want to be looking at trade claims data to understand where the blocks are. But assuming we get to a place where there's you know, a standing peace that, you know, sort of moves on, in 3 months, people might want to look at the flow through to inflation in the US, and they want to look at a cross section of data assets that have pricing on orange juice and things like that. And, you know, rather than buy the data for a year, they might want to look at it for 3 months. There are ways to figure that out. And so you can start trading in and out of data structure based on the frameworks that you care about at that time.
So just a quick plug for your team here. You've mentioned the Strait of Hormuz. I've read an excellent analysis from your team, maybe yesterday or the day before it was published. I'm going to include the link in the description of this video so people can check it out. It's a must read. It's an excellent report backed by data showing the trajectory, you know, of like how and where the oil gets shipped and what happens downstream. Really nice report. Everybody should read it. So I also want to ask about the actual consumers of the data and the questions that they have. What other stuff are they asking? What's possible now, especially given that AI has now entered the scene and you can do a lot more robust analysis, I guess, a broad range of names. What are the types of things that they're asking now with this better technology versus before that they couldn't even start querying the data this way?
You know, there's sort of two parts. One, what's interesting is, you know, we rolled out our AI front end embedded in our MCP on the platform. And so people have the capability to ask natural language and query across the entire data structure. And what's cool about it is, you know, and I play around in there a lot because I'm trying to figure out the, you know, optimization of prompting, which is where I think there's some competitive advantage and that's where some alpha I think is going to reside. But, you know, fundamentally, you know, what's interesting is not only, you know, back in the day when you had 1010 publishing their trend reports, you had your internal card panels in 2014 and 2015, you had a finite number of questions that you could ask.
Yes.
Because it was defined by where you were spending your capital on data. And most people were buying card, click, app, and geo as the four core assets, which even today, you know, sort of if you're buying row level, can have you spending $2.5 to $3 million of the rent.
Yep.
That's before compute and before you do anything with it. So it's not a cheap endeavor, and it doesn't include headcount.
That's just the data, not the people you need to analyze it.
And yeah, there's a cross overlap on there about 100 tickers, and your long retail, your long restaurants, and your long sort of what I would call new media or web names. And by the way, can build a nice franchise around that, but that's fairly saturated at this point. It really comes down to the questions you ask and really understanding the events and the catalysts and the underlying names and how you're going to approach understanding those. But what's cool about this is like the breadth of data actually expands the aperture for the types of questions you can ask, right? And so, but you know, sort of there's a learning curve, right? Because when you're exposed to new areas to sort of engage and you haven't been there before, there's a curve on the front end and then a curve on the back end. And so, you know, sort of what we're seeing is a lot of exploration happening in the MCP. And then we're seeing people go in and engage and take data down out of the API because then they want to work on it in their own environment. So it's acting as both the discovery platform as well as a first order analytics framework. And then people are going in and doing the deeper work. So it's a really, the questions are less, and frankly, I don't see them. They go into a repository, but I'm not looking at them. And then we're not training on any of that stuff or anything like that. It's only to make sure that the systems work, and we don't retain them. But you know, sort of fundamentally, where we're for long anyway, we retain them for a period of time. But what I think is most interesting is watching the action and the movement from MCP into the platform to pull data down.
Yeah. So you've mentioned something in a recent interview, and it stuck with me. You're not building the platform for 8 billion humans, but 30 billion AI agents. That's like, you know, that's where it's going, right? Like eventually people are going to have AI agents that are doing all this research work and pulling the data down from Carbon Arc and all these different partners. Is that really what's happening now? Do you see that trajectory even for the smaller funds that don't really understand agentic AI yet?
Well, here's the thing, right? So the thing that I think is going to happen is, we're in this phase where, you know, whether it's token maxing or, you know, sort of the spend that you're seeing out of the big guys and the amount of capital that's flowing into the space, you know, fundamentally, we look at the AI economy and we think it's models, chips, models being, you know, sort of traditional, you know, language models, but also the app layer on top of the language models, and then the agentic workflows. Those are all just, you know, sort of models. The thesis we're building around is that at the end of the day, as we move to a more programmatic world, complexity needs to be reduced. And so what I mean by that is we have one MCP. We have several tools on that MCP that allow for the agents to query our data structure in a very optimized and token optimized way. The belief being that in the app layer, as everyone builds on top of the foundation models, assuming that is where the world continues to go, and we can have a longer conversation around foundation models and are they the first wave or are they around forever? Yeah. I think there's a debate there. What gets really interesting is in a model-driven world where everybody's building apps and chasing the same customers, where does the differentiation reside, right? And so our argument is that the differentiation resides in the diversity of data structure that your model sits. And, you know, rather than having a situation where you're hitting 14 MCPs to get an answer, we think that creates latency, cost structure dynamics, and the likelihood of being wrong to sort of go up, as you add each new element, because you have to do entity resolution, you have to deal with, query structure, you have to deal with, is Walmart the same behind each one of your MCPs, right? So, like, I do think that the agentic economy is coming and will force more simplicity in the context layer and in sort of the way sort of data structure is formed in the back. We're getting reached out to by agent-to-agent marketplaces and proxies. It started about 6 to 8 weeks ago in earnest. I think by the end of this year, you will start to see a lot of, models of models working on top of, your frame to do different workflows inside of, different actions, both in funds, but also in businesses. You're going to start to see incumbents with huge market share in their traditional SaaS businesses actually have the system of record for their data and build agent workflows on top of the SaaS businesses. So I don't think SaaS is dead like everybody talks about because they have a ton of data, right? I actually think,
but the value shifts from like the analytics layer and the dashboards or whatever that you don't really need with agents and down to the actual data.
And I think they have a prime position. It's either partner with AI first companies to do that because they have the system of record, right? Yeah. They have the data structure, and like a lot of people don't have the decision trace data. They're trying to build it. You know, fundamentally what we went and did was we went out and partnered with a number of suppliers. We have 100 trillion transactions, which is a system of record for the world's decisions over the last day.
Awesome. So let's shift gears just a little bit. Your DNA is hedge funds, and you've worked with some of the best managers in the world, and you've led the data efforts there. Talk to me a little bit about Alpha. So now you're democratizing this access to data. You're solving the friction that's really been around since the beginning of alternative data in the industry. What does it mean for the industry's ability to generate alpha? Is there like this gravity that's going to eventually pull down the value for everybody that they can get out of this data? Or is there some way that we can continue to generate alpha? And it really depends on how you combine these signals and so on.
Oh yeah. So, I love talking about alpha because, you know, sort of the way I think about alpha is it's competitive advantage, right? Excess return, however you want to define it. For me, using the credit card example again, 2013, you had card data and you're modeling it against 100 names. There was alpha and halving. The moves were wide. There was an information arbitrage that existed. And then that became something that was really interesting for a couple of years. And then it started to proliferate. As it proliferated, names started moving earlier in the cycle when there was good data, for example. You could see it show up in the market. You could see when things were hitting, inside a different firm because things were moving, whatever, right? So alpha started to move, right? Yeah. And then you look at the consumer space and everybody's got credit card data now. It trades very differently than it used to, right? And there are a lot of people in consumer that aren't as close to the names that, you know, sort of trade the names, right? So it became a space other participants could come into when traditionally used to be specialists, right? So it starts to become a generalist space. That's not totally true, but, I've seen examples of it. So alpha moves. So then you have to figure out how you're going to sort of capture alpha. Where is it going to live? It's going to live in your domain knowledge and, you know, sort of your persistence in a name, which means you move it from, from a 2-week to 2-month setup framework to 6 months. And you have 6-month stories and you trade around volatility. But, you know, as more data proliferates, what happens is if access to data before used to be the alpha and the access stops being the alpha generator, then it becomes the questions you ask in the data structure that you create, right? So just like portfolio construction has become a competitive in quant space and at the multi-strats and the risk frameworks that people employ, can be alpha generators based on how they manage portfolios. Because AI to me is just a model-driven decision-making framework, which is the same as a quant fund or what happens at a lot of the large multi-strats, you know, fundamentally how people manage their input, how people think about their catalysts, how people think about all of their decisions, you know, fundamentally you're just creating another framework because these are cash flow predictors. At the end of the day, that when we talk about external data or alternative data, what it actually is a predictor of is what's happening in the real world. And if a fundamental analyst is looking at a company and what they're going to earn and what people are willing to pay for it, P&E, right? Sort of in quants are looking at the asset of a stock. As how it performs against itself and against each other in a statistically significant way, fundamentally you're modeling cash flows. So, where I believe you'll see alpha reside is in organizational alpha around how people take strong domain knowledge, breadth of domain knowledge and embed that into, sectors. And I'll also say if consumer and what I would call media internet, they've been 80% of the data that most of the data that has resided. Industrial still has never been sort of a huge data space outside of like incumbent table stakes data assets like a CoStar. Healthcare has had sort of claims, but in some EMR, but those have been less stable over time, and those are relatively new on the data side. So I would still make the argument that there's still a lot of wood to chop around data accessibility. And the big guys still have an advantage because they know what they're doing. They've done it for a long time and they have the install bases and teams that have been integrating this into their processes for well over a decade. And so there's still a learning curve on those, just like there's a learning curve when a new fund starts and doesn't have the same risk data history that a traditional firm does, right? And so I do think that organizational alpha matters. I think experience matters. I think time to process will matter. I think time to alpha matters, and that's why these frictions being removed matter. And then I think it's really about sort of having a great world model, understanding context, and understanding how everything works together, which means you have to have a really rigorous fundamental research process at your firm, even if you're a quant. Because as more of this data proliferates, it's going to impact how these how companies engage in the world.
It's another input. It's a complicated input. It's nuanced. And it just makes the process of evaluating your inputs as an investment manager that much more important. Because now you have signal that contains alpha. Other people might also be seeing it. How are you going to use it? How are you going to look at it? Which it brings me to another question. Given your DNA as an investor, you've specifically structured CarbonARC to service many other verticals besides the finance vertical and the investors. You're also selling into corporates. You're selling into Hollywood, apparently. Help me think about that. How do they use this sort of data?
So that's what I think is a fun part of the whole thing. And the thing I'll say just to qualify is I always was helping investors. I wasn't picking stocks. The businesses I ran, which I think is an important construct inside of large firms, we didn't have P&L. I wasn't paid on P&L. Our job was to sort of produce the best input possible to help the themes make more money and to do it in a way that was legal and compliant. I do think that's important because it's you know, it was a specific and sort of rigid line between sort of P&L producers and the businesses I was involved in. But fundamentally, like when you think about the construct of CarbonArk and what we've built in our data structure, all of our data comes in from all of these different places, and there's an entity resolve at the beginning, which basically finds companies, brands, people, meaning cohorts, and locations. It could be zip code, it can be a venue, it can be a state, it could be a country. And those get resolved off the rim, and that's what goes into our graph. And it goes into our graph because that is the primary key that we then manage everything around. So if somebody comes in and asks about Lululemon, it automatically prunes everything away from Lulu, and then it focuses you specifically on where Lulu lives in your state, which is wildly efficient, fast, and cheaper, right? So that's the thing. When you have an entity, the next thing you have is an event. So the thing that I've learned in my career is that an entity plus an event equals an expected or desired outcome. There are five types of events at CarbonArk. There's macro events, there's corporate events, that's an earnings print, there's calendar events, that's a three-day weekend, Black Friday, anything that happens every year on the same day, Easter, right? There's industry events like CES or AHAM or the Grammys. And then the last, those are all top-down. Those all just happen to companies and people. And there's a bottoms-up set of events. The ones that we think about are, and they're called company events in our staff. Company events are decisions that management teams make to goose revenues or cut costs. Main Street is trying to optimize those events. Wall Street is trying to figure out if they're any good at it. That is the mirror, the two-sided mirror in our business. So when Bad Bunny decides whether or not he wants to go to the Super Bowl and be at the Super Bowl, there's a decision point on whether that's a good opportunity cost of his, you know, sort of when you're trading Kalshi, you're trying to make a bet as to whether or not Bad Bunny, benefited from the Super Bowl or not when you're tracking it versus Bruno Mars, because it was a contract between Bruno Mars and Bad Bunny in February, for example. So you've got a risk taker trying to understand the decision that Bad Bunny made, and Bad Bunny's making the decision based on how Rihanna did, based on Kendrick Lamar, what that meant for their other brands, and all of those things. It's all the same data.
And they all need the data.
It's all the same data. Now, there's a learning curve on Main Street, but, you know, with natural language and all this other stuff, you can see, people getting more sort of heads wrapped around the ability, because like there's always a cost problem, a usability problem.
Yes.
And so we're trying to remove those.
They're not going to be building these models with, you know, 25 different factors and R squares and all that. They want to be asking a question just like you and me, but get a data backed answer that's intelligent and based on something.
That's right. And so, you know, so we have, you know, sort of, we about half our customers are off Wall Street. And what's cool is we have small and medium sized businesses that work with us. We've got professional sports teams. It's really been sort of, we've learned a lot about the use cases, away, from Wall Street, because, you know, sort of Wall Street also sort of, has always optimized towards the strongest signals. And part of that is because of the cost structure. If the cost structure, you know, because at the end of the day, you're trying to create lift. Every firm on Wall Street has a hit rate. And, you know, if they're going to use data, you have to approve that hit rate, or you're not going to stick around for long, right? And then sort of the key is to lower the cost of that hit rate lift so that they're generating a hard ROI on it, and they keep pulling more data in to keep boosting. And that's the whole game. And whether it's Main Street or Wall Street, you're just trying to sell hit rate or conversion rate.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. So as we wrap up, what's like the most exciting thing that you guys are working on? What's really gets you going? What is the big opportunity that CarbonArk is going after right now?
So we're pushing into a couple areas. So one of the things we've been playing around with is we launched Lenses, and one of the things that we're looking at coming out with is we want folks who are engaged with CarbonArk, if they're developing, sort of frameworks, i.e., a great sort of framework for, you know, jet fuel pricing, right? We want them to be able to list it so people can, right? So we're starting to create, a more substantial developer community. We just launched, sort of a soft launch. A $20 a month, sort of professional account. And we've got students and people trading on Robinhood, sort of doing the work in there, giving us a ton of feedback, but we're going in hard here in Q2, getting a hedge fund data stack into the hands of someone trading Interactive Brokers or Robinhood for $20 a month is pretty interesting. Wow. And then we want to give the same tools, to SMBs. who are trying to manage their top of funnel, trying to figure out how to price their menu, trying to figure out which cohorts are still spending and if their zip code is facing macro challenges because of inflation, being able to build into those tool sets to help, you know, folks manage their business better, so that we can just get people turning on the data, because that we pay data providers. And the more we pay data providers, the more data providers will want to work with us. And then the flywheel just keeps to expand. The other thing we're doing...
It's a positive network effect.
Yeah, that's right. The other thing we're doing is we're spending a lot of time outside the U.S. right now and having conversations in Southeast Asia, South Asia, East Asia, and Africa to start pulling in and making markets and data in those markets, because we're seeing a lot of international demand for international data, but also domestic demand for international data, especially as geopolitics get really wacky.
I want to thank you for being a guest on the podcast. You are a wealth of knowledge. Thank you so much, Kirk.
Thank you for having me. This was awesome. I really appreciate it.
Really appreciate you being a guest. And where can everybody find you if they wanted to ask you a question, or maybe there's a customer or a prospect that's listening to the podcast? Where do they go to ask you a question?
Yeah, just email me. It's kirk@carbonarc.ca.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. Everybody, take care. We'll see you in the next one. Thanks for tuning into Momentum. If you found today's episode valuable, don't forget to follow the show and share it with your network. This helps us a lot. To explore how AI can help your firm, visit acadia.im. I'm Stan Altschuler, and I'll see you next week with more practical insights to help turn data into growth and decisions into results with the help of AI.